You know, keeping up with what's going on in the world can sometimes feel like more trouble than it's worth. There's so much information flying around, it's almost impossible to get anything of value out of it all. But that's what Assorted Goods is all about. Every episode, your host, Dan, me, takes the time to break down and dive into a collection of news stories and topics, big or small, past or present. It's a podcaster's journey to learn a little more about the world, one story at a time. So stop by, kick back, relax, and join me in my efforts to figure out some of the craziness, and maybe have a couple laughs along the way. Find Assorted Goods wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you there.
Well, the unemployment figure for this state is 8%. Think of it. The biggest, the richest, the most powerful country cannot keep its full job force working. It cannot tend all its sick people. It cannot feed all its hungry people or decently house its poor people. It cannot educate everyone who needs an education. I say there has got to be a better way. To me, that's what this election is all about. Because the time has passed when you can turn your back on the fundamental needs of the people. And don't think that you can distract them anymore by playing off the young against the old, the black against the white, the poor against the less poor. I think the time has come when the American people realize that we're in this together. And that we sink or swim together. And I say to you, maybe, just maybe, that that's the way it should be. A test of our courage, of our compassion, our faith in ourselves, and our faith in our country. No candidate can come before you and say that he's got all the answers. All a man can say is, here I am. And that's what I say to you tonight. Here I am. I'm willing to give it all I've got. Let's make a beginning.
Saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection. Some background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review. We are continuing this October's theme, Electile Dysfunction. That's our selection of some very interesting political films that's just perfect for this, oh, let's call it an interesting time. This week, we screen the Michael Ritchie prescient satire, 1972's The Candidate. Please, join us! This week's film has been a favorite of mine ever since I saw it back when I was an undergrad in college. I had decided to go on a political movie bender in the weeks leading up to the 2004 election, and this was one of those films that I ended up screening in my dorm room back in the day. Like most things I screened, it was met with muted responses from those in attendance, while, of course, I loved it. But hey, such is life. And in the years that followed, I would just continually go back to it as a favorite to be watched every couple of years just to get in the right frame of mind before an election cycle. I mean, seriously, how can you actually go wrong with this? You have a fantastic director, a real political writer who's scripting all of this, and a young and at the height of his powers, Robert Redford, involved in this film. What more could you want? Oh, wait, now you're telling me this is based on an actual person? Do tell. Let's get right down to brass tacks. If you ever want to know the whole story and how this was inspired, you have to start with the inspiration for the character that Redford plays themselves, the very real U.S. Senator John V. Tunney. Born in New York, June 26, 1934, John Varick Tunney was the son of heavyweight boxing champion J. Joseph Tunney and socialite Polly Lauder Tunney. He ended up growing up in a childhood of privilege in Stamford, Connecticut. He graduated from Yale University, and then he studied international law at The Hague in the Netherlands before he came back to earn his own law degree at the University of Virginia in 1959, where he met a young man who would become his lifelong friend, one Edward Ted Kennedy. According to Tunney, they just bumped into each other outside of a lecture hall one day, and they ended up chatting a bit, Kennedy mentioning that he thought John's father had actually helped his father get a sauna put in and their house on the Cape. After this conversation, Tunney ended up going back to his room, called his dad, mentioned that he met this really nice guy who claims his dad knows you, and the elder Tunney was at first sort of dismissive until Joe Kennedy's name got dropped, at which point he apparently commented, "Yes, the ambassador? Oh, he's wonderful. Yes, we helped him put that sauna in." As it would happen, the two youths would end up meeting up after class often. They'd get together, they'd have lunch, they'd play football, and after a year or so of sharing some meals and sports and conversations, they ended up becoming roommates. Well, roommates, air quotes, in the way wealthy people of means do. I mean, two 20-somethings who end up living in a rented-out country estate house just to themselves, with their own personal maid who does their laundry, cooking, and cleaning. You know, roommates. Oh, so I'm not trying to underplay all of this, but it was here that they would start to have their debates and their real talks. And it's these kind of talks that would shape how they kind of spent the rest of their lives. It was Kennedy who would confide in Tunney that he actually wasn't too sure about actually taking a career in politics, as his brothers had done before him. At the time, he was considering buying a football team and running it, you know, trying to get the NFL to let them in. You know, like you do when you're in your 20s. It was Kennedy who actually started getting Tunney into politics, and what's more, got him to think of a broader worldview than his initial familial conservative roots. Tunney did end up practicing law in both Virginia and New York. He got married and started a family. Oh, by the way, just like, you know, normal people do, he ended up marrying a Dutch princess. He married Mieke Sprengers. He then went on to serve as a judge advocate in the United States Air Force. He relocated his family in 1961, taking a position teaching business law at the University of California, Riverside. He passed the bar in California, and at that point, his old roommate Ted Kennedy had already ran for Senate in Massachusetts and had won his seat in 1962. It was then that Ted reached out to him and asked him, "Hey, come on board, work for my brother Bobby in the Justice Department." At this point, though, Tunney himself had gotten the itch, and he had wanted to make his own run for Congress in California. So he agreed to come on as an advisor for John F. Kennedy's Presidential Committee on Juvenile Delinquency and Youth Crime. It was part of Kennedy's Executive Order 10940. And Ted used that as an opportunity to show Tunney the ins and the outs of Washington and start to introduce him around to the folks before he even got there. When the time came for his first run at Congress a few months later in 1964, it was done with a cadre of Kennedy-picked and Kennedy-funded professionals who stepped in to help and support Tunney. And I might add, Tunney never asked for this. This was what you get when you're friends with the Kennedys. They got his campaign organized, they showed him how to spend money, how to spin press his way. Tragically, it would be the fact that JFK had been killed in November of 63 that had made the Kennedy endorsement of Tunney's campaign even more high profile, and he ended up sailing into Congress and into the House of Representatives, a Democrat representing California's 38th district, a seat that he would hold for the next 6 years. It was during this time that the old college roommates were again completely immersed. Family weekend gatherings, joint holidays, working government together. But it was also Tunney who would be called in to the scene of one of the worst days in Kennedy life. He was there to help his old friend on the night of July 19th, 1969. When Ted Kennedy was involved in the famous car crash that led to the death of campaign worker Mary Jo Kopechne in what would become known as the Chappaquiddick incident. For good or ill, it was Tunney who was called that following morning to come and see Ted before the authorities were ever contacted. And later, it would be Tunney, who was part of a larger legal team, who would advise and try to help defend Kennedy against the manslaughter charges. After a grand jury investigation, it was found that while Kennedy was potentially at fault, there was not enough evidence to actually indict him on potential charges of manslaughter, perjury, or reckless driving. And Kennedy was essentially let free. By 1970, Tunney had considered himself to now be a seasoned politician. And that's when he made it known that he would be challenging the California Republican Senator, former actor George Lloyd Murphy, for his seat. But to do that, he would have to first fend off a challenger from fellow Democrat George Brown Jr. And it was during their primary race that a bitterly contentious fight was had. Tunney had taken the position that he was against further expansion of the Vietnam War itself, yet he was in favor of the institution of the draft. Tunney eventually managed to shut his challenger out and then take on the elder Murphy, but due to everything that had happened during the primary, Murphy was considered to be the clear winner. There was just too much scorched earth talk on behalf of Tunney. Yet, there was a difference between them. The young man was still technically against the war, whereas Murphy was all for it. And hey, in 1970, those were the kind of differences that could cost or win people their seats, provided Tunney could show Murphy to be out of touch with the rest of the country. Tunney allowed himself to be repackaged, rebranded, and completely changed up his messaging to show the glaring differences between Murphy and himself. He touted his youth, he styled his hair to be reminiscent of JFK, and he took every opportunity he could to show that he was both dynamic, outgoing, and ready to do the job, contrasting himself against his 69-year-old opponent. Murphy, at the time, had been diagnosed with throat cancer, and he had a croaking, whispery speech that did not inspire confidence in the populace. Tunney himself was all flash and little substance. And you know what? It worked. He was sent to the Senate in January of 1971, where he would stay, serving only a single 6-year term. He was considered to be far too hawkish, and what's more, he was rather unreliable in showing up to the Senate to cast votes. Tunney would eventually lose his seat to Republican challenger S.I. Hayakawa in 1976. Tunney's political career was essentially done at this point, but his story, one of a man changing so many things about himself, sparked an interest in a young speechwriter named Jeremy Larner. Now, Larner was a man who was very familiar with Tunney through all the time he had spent working in the Democratic trenches, particularly being with Senator Eugene McCarthy's presidential campaign against Nixon in 1968. Larner had already been writing books about his past campaign life, and he had been mixing with Hollywood crowds and running in various circles, writing screenplays, advocating for peace against the war, that sort of thing. This put him in contact with celebrities like Jack Nicholson, Paul Newman, and Michael Ritchie. Oh, also one Mr. Robert Redford. Michael Ritchie, director, had already been actively working for Tunney's campaign in California, and he knew the man well. And thus, through conversations between Larner, Ritchie, and Redford, they thought, hey, we have a pretty good idea for a film here. Each of them bringing their own level of disappointment and disenchantment with the political process. Case in point, Redford would later comment on making the film during a TCM guest programming segment held in 2018 with Ben Mankiewicz, mentioning that he basically became completely disillusioned with politics after 1968. And it wasn't just focusing on the fallout from the disastrous Democratic convention that was held in Chicago, but instead it came from just politics becoming the packaging of the candidates. You know, getting involved in the process, you see the loss of substance and a focus instead on pure cosmetics. Tunney would be their poster child. Now, Ritchie and Redford had already worked together on Downhill Racer back in 1969, so they were well acquainted with each other's styles. This was actually going to happen. So, summer 1971 was spent with Larner hammering out a screenplay and Ritchie and Redford just encouraging him along the process and ramping up production, basically working to get Warner Brothers on board to fund and distribute the picture. Warner Brothers, understandably, was leery of making political waves at this time, so Redford promised he would own the project if it tanked. He gave them his guarantee, and Warner Brothers reluctantly ended up shelling out $1.6 million on a budget. Redford claims it was he who pushed to have the film shot in a documentary style, which made it feel more real and gave the audience the impression that they were just going to be along for the ride, as if they were embedded with his character's actual campaign. Peter Boyle was brought on, cast as the political manager and basically political Svengali, Marvin Lucas. The great Melvin Douglas himself, no stranger to politics based on the fact that his wife, Helen Gehenna Douglas, had served as California's 14th District Representative to Congress from 1945 to 1951. He was cast as the main character's father, a former governor and a ruthless political animal to boot. Throw in the character actor Donald Porter to play the rival, Senator Jarman, and call in a personal favor and get Natalie Wood essentially to come out of retirement to play herself as a favorite of Redford, and by Jove, you've got yourself a movie here. Now, we could talk about this some more, but you've been ever so good and patient. How about we just get to that trailer?
Says that he's taking his case to the public. Well, then why does he refuse to meet me in open debate? We have to fit the last trend.
I'm sorry, I'll have it fixed in a second.
Put that damn phone down and let's get this straight. I want to know what the hell this campaign is.
Okay, now, for starters, we got to cut your hair in 86 and sideburns.
All right, let's go.
I wonder if anybody understood what I was trying to do.
Don't worry, son. It won't make any difference.
But increasingly in this country, candidates are merging the two, selling themselves like an underarm deodorant in commercials just long enough to pound in some mindless slogan that cheapens candidate and voter alike. Those early hard statements of his are turning into mush. Specific policies dissolve into old generalities. The voters are being asked to choose McKay the way they choose a detergent.
You look uptight and uncool. Nobody's listening. Nobody's digging you.
Let's go for a walk on the beach.
We could talk on the way to the banquet.
Or we could not go to the banquet. I just want to talk.
Don't do this.
Sorry, am I late? Black against the white.
Vote once. Vote twice for Bill McKay. You middle-class honkies.
It's going to be decided by you.
What about the group in San Diego?
Never mind that. We've got a fire in Malibu. It's perfect.
The poor against the less poor.
Losing 15 minutes of free airtime is like throwing away $80,000. Now go on, Rich.
The young against the old. Our faith in ourselves and our faith in our country.
Marvin Lucas, as played by Peter Boyle, is a political hack. I believe he would prefer the term election specialist, who is in need of a new gig. His last prospective candidate had just lost his race, and now he's looking for the next promising young challenger to field against the incumbent California Republican Senator Crocker Jarman, as played by Don Porter, a man who Lucas views as being out of touch and ripe for taking down. Lucas has a problem, though. No established Democrat wants to take Jarman on, viewing the entire ordeal as an exercise in futility. Jarman is respected, connected, and frankly, he's been, at least all things considered, doing a decent job. So why waste time and treasure on an unwinnable race? A lawyer and community organizer, Bill McKay, as played by Redford, is the happily married son of a former California governor, John J. McKay, even though he has some different liberal politics from his old man. He's outspoken, he's passionate, he doesn't want to seek political office. To Lucas, he, on paper, is perfect. Lucas finds McKay and approaches him in his modest office and makes him a pitch. Be the opposition candidate to Jarman.
Marvin?
Yeah.
What's in it for you?
Oh, an air card, a phone card, $1,000 a week.
And that's all?
Well,
Marvin wants me to go into politics.
What else is new? What office?
Senator.
Well, why not? If he really put his mind to it. That means you'd have to register. He never has, you know.
Hasn't been any reason.
Well, I hope you keep that a secret.
Unless you took it serious.
Look, the point is, you can go with the things you believe in. For openers, you've got credibility. You've got the name.
What do you mean, the name? You're not going to bring my father into this.
Okay, we won't.
He's got the looks.
Right.
And he's got the power.
What does that mean?
You know what that means.
No, I don't.
Well, you gentlemen will excuse me. I have to remove some film from the bathtub before it rots.
You're saying I can say what I want, do what I want, go where I please.
It's right. Here's your guarantee.
I lose.
That's it. So what are you worried about? You're free, McKay. You don't have a chance, so say what you want. It's just between you and the public. The question is whether you can put your ass on the line.
Now the question is whether it's worth it.
Intrigued with the notion that because he can't win, he is thus free to do and say anything he wants to help express his values to mainstream voters, McKay eventually is sold on the idea, and he makes his initial pitch, throwing his hat into the ring for the race for the Senate seat. Completely green and going on just what he feels are some basic quote, good things to do, he is quickly taken to task for not having glib answers for things, which both makes him interesting to the press to follow and makes him also an easy target for mockery.
Done rolling.
Today, at 10 o'clock, I filed the papers to enter my name in the Democratic primary as a candidate for the United States Senate. Any questions?
Community Legal Service.
Why are you doing this? Because I don't think the incumbent is really in touch with how people live or what they need. That's what I tried to do as a lawyer, and that's what I hope to go on doing as a candidate.
How do you feel about welfare?
We subsidize trains, we subsidize planes. Why not subsidize people?
What about busing?
What about it?
What's your stand on it?
I'm for it.
That's a first. What would you do about property taxes?
I don't know.
Jesus.
What is the platform? So what do you mean platform?
Bill, would you mind moving over there with your office staff?
No. Sorry, any other questions?
Why won't you move over there with your staff?
They're not responsible for me.
No other Democrats step up to challenge him, so he suddenly finds himself fighting an uphill battle, trying to make appearances, shooting commercials, making public engagements, taking photo ops with people who are not paying him any mind at all, other than a small cadre of loyal supporters who believe in his liberal causes of a clean environment, pushing to provide basic rights of health care and welfare to those in need, and focusing on positive race relations. He ends up having a series of disastrous meetings, a photo op gone bad in Watts, a series of empty shopping mall speeches, and it starts to make the young man feel like he has been set up to fail.
Here, look, you can still read it. I got it. I'm a little disappointed.
Why? I've got 47% of the primary field.
Yeah, but if you look at the projection on the printout, it adds up to 32% in the election.
Right, so?
So if those figures hold until November, it'll be Jarman 68, McKay 32.
I thought I was supposed to lose.
Well, now I'm telling you, you'll be wiped out. Be humiliated.
That wasn't part of the deal.
Somebody's in here.
Maybe I should just quit.
You can't quit.
Go back.
Don't be ridiculous.
You can't go back. You're the Democratic nominee for senator.
So you make that sound like a death sentence.
No. All that means is that you're just reaching the people who agree with you already. Now we have to go after the rest.
Yeah? And what does that mean?
Well, it means more in terms of TV, for one thing.
Like what? I mean, I already agreed to the...
Get your ass out of here!
Look, there's a lot to be done. We're just starting.
Such as? The election will be over. I mean, tell me what has to be... Oh, I can't think. Can't we talk about this in the morning?
All right.
This leads to McKay confronting Lucas, concerned that while he understood he wasn't going to win, he doesn't want to have his good name ruined either. And then he asks the political fixer just what he can do. We are then treated to McKay expanding his campaign across California, his message continually getting watered down, his very specific promises made all the more generic. And it begins to work. He picks up traction, he gets more followers, more donors, and the campaign gets bigger and bigger. And yet he still trails Jarman. Lucas hits upon the crux of the issue. McKay has purposely been keeping his father out of the race, wanting to do this on his own. Here's the problem. The voters and the media have interpreted this as the elder former Governor McKay, as played by Melvin Douglas, not really having faith in his son, and instead his silence is a tacit endorsement of his opponent. They have a very awkward televised meeting where the elder McKay spins the story that he's been trying to stay out of the race to honor his son's wishes, and that he is fully committed to seeing Bill go to the Senate. This spikes McKay's numbers, and now he's actually a real threat to Jarman. And the two end up meeting to have a televised debate, where McKay performs admirably. That is, until he decides to have a crisis of conscience. At the end, during his closing remarks, he blurts out that he still hasn't been able to address the things that he cares about. The things he views are still real problems. Poverty, welfare, race relations.
We come now to our concluding statements. Each candidate will have 1 minute. The order was picked by the flip of a coin, and Senator Jarman will go first. Senator Jarman.
To me, this country was never stronger. But the test of a strong country is how it faces its difficulties. So now and then, when I hear the barking and the baying of those who would knock our system down, I am reminded of the last days of the great Roman Empire. They argued about what vices they could legalize. And what happened was an onslaught that nearly spelled the end of civilization. Now, I am not suggesting that that is what will happen if the people do not send me back to the Senate. I just promise you this. I will continue to stand up for the philosophy that has made this nation great and is more than ever called for if we are to face the future with hope and confidence. I have that hope because I believe in America. I believe that our greatest moment is yet to come. Thank you.
Mr. McKay, you now have 1 minute to sum up. Mr. McKay.
In the beginning, I think it's important to note what subjects we haven't discussed. We've completely ignored the fact that this is a society divided by fear, hatred, and violence. And until we talk about just what this society really is, then I don't know how we're going to change it. For example, we haven't discussed the rot that destroys our cities. We have all the resources we need to check it, and we don't use them. And we haven't discussed why not. We haven't discussed race in this country. We haven't discussed poverty. In short, we haven't discussed any of the sicknesses that may yet send this country up in flames. And we better do it. We'd better get it out in the open and confront it before it's too late.
Gentlemen,
now just a moment, please.
Gentlemen,
you had to do it, didn't you?
I never dreamed that my country would stoop to encouraging violence.
I beg your pardon,
very seriously doubt that any man could do that.
Gentlemen,
it's paid
it in there. One on two.
This has been the Jarman-McCabe debate. You've been watching it tonight.
Nice news in Philadelphia, Rod Perry.
Lucas is understandably frustrated and angry with McKay, and the press are waiting backstage, ready to eviscerate the young hopeful with a bunch of questions. But that's just when his father theatrically greets him in front of the cameras, loudly congratulating him and telling him how proud he is of him, all done with the hungry look of an old political animal who is spinning a moment to his favor, and the press fall for it. Not covering the gaffe during the debate, but instead shifting the entire story of the evening to the father-son reconciliation. The governor then teams up with Lucas and begins to pull strings to get McKay to meet with some labor union representatives, something that the young liberal has been very reluctant to do. He doesn't want to associate with what he feels are people who have corrupted what unions stood for. The meeting doesn't actually seem to go well. The union reps, although still not friendly and open towards McKay, and McKay openly hostile towards them, agree that they will support him and are won over. Now, with everything in place, the polls are going to be where McKay and Jarman will have to duke it out. They are essentially tied. It's all up to the voters. McKay is worried and cagey, but his father and handlers all seem perfectly fine with the situation, and they're already quietly discussing long-term plans and deals that they will be making and cutting once Bill gets into office. As the polls begin to come back in, it shows that McKay has won, and he is mobbed by his staff and supporters and well-wishers. desperate to get a word in with Lucas, he ends up pulling the political hack back into a hotel room just to have a quick 30-second conversation where he is still shocked and bewildered about everything that has just happened to him. Unable to process it, he tries to at least ask Lucas a burning question.
Okay, we've got about 60 seconds of privacy before they find out we're here now, so what's on your mind, Senator?
I don't know.
Okay, you gotta get out of there. See, I told you they'd be...
Marvin, what do we do now?
Wait a minute, what?
Unable to hold the staff and media pounding at the door, both Lucas and McKay are swept out of the room and out into the halls, never giving or receiving a good answer. Credits roll. Oh man, where do we even begin? Well, let's talk first about something that doesn't work for me as I watch this film now a good 20 years after I had first seen it, and almost 50 years after it had hit the big screen. The ending. Full disclosure, I like this film. I wouldn't be talking about it if I didn't, and I wouldn't be recommending it if I didn't think it was worth seeing. But now, the ending strikes me very differently as I see it now than when I first saw it as a younger man. Redford claims that the concept of this film was always born on the notion of that last line, and they work backwards from there. The film is a complete example of a Pyrrhic victory. You destroyed your opponent at all cost, and you traded on one's ideals and sold your soul in the process. You are left winning, but with nothing. It's powerful, it's cutting edge, for its day. It's an iconic shot. You have McKay and Lucas trying to catch a quick word alone before the crowd of well-wishers break down the door. McKay is trying to ask a poignant question. His, what do we do now? When this film was released, that was some heavy shit. It was funny, it was telling, and in a country that was still not yet fully woke to exactly what was coming with Watergate, and or the assorted skullduggery that politics actually delved into, this was the right line for the time. But watching it now, it really, at least for me, hasn't aged well. You have a young, good-looking, albeit novice politician who learns he can't coast on the perception of being just that. Instead, he's forced to modify himself, to become a product that is to be bought and sold by the populace at large. And each step of the way, he's giving up a little more of himself in the process. I get it. He's saying formulaic catchphrases, he's holding still for photo ops, he's meeting with people he doesn't really want to associate with, just to garner votes that he needs to actually get the job so he can hopefully get his foot in the door. The film really isn't about a person who is inept, so to me, the ending is somewhat of a throwaway. It's sort of disingenuous. I don't think Bill McKay, as a character, is so naive that he is unaware of the job he's going to have to do. So this leaves the ending to be interpreted a few ways. A, he's given up on some of his most basic ideals. B, he is now molded into being a process politician, and he's looking for the next task to check off. C, he's asking if he can now finally get down to the work that he's been wanting to do this entire time that we've been seeing him on screen. If anybody wants to watch this movie and make the argument that McKay is still wet behind the ears as an idealist, then what are we to make of the weird small subplot of him having the affair with the young staffer? We are instead watching the transformation, and if you are of a certain bent, the corruption of a hopeful man who starts to see that, yes, politics is a vehicle for him to help people and get his message out, but it is also a machine that can be used for his own self-gratification and enrichment. Interestingly, it was Redford who insisted and maintained that McKay, while he has this implied affair, he's going to have it without her talking. The mistress was specifically told not to be given a speaking part, mainly because Redford thought the public would not accept him as having an affair if the character was made real through dialogue. Now, on its face, that's kind of ridiculous, but it speaks to Redford's ego. In hindsight, though, it actually serves the story very well, because the subtlety makes you more aware of his slow corruption, and it's all the better because it's done very, very quietly. And by having her not be more than seen, we only slowly begin to get a real sense of the compromises that McKay as a character is making in his life. Now let me pivot for you. Let me talk about what I love about this film. Peter Boyle and his portrayal of Lucas. He's not a bad guy. He's not a good guy. He's a political animal, pure and simple. He's indifferent to the personal choices and the beliefs of the candidates that he is employed to help. His only goal is to win. And he knows that this young man is going to take the bait. And when he tells McKay he can do anything that he wants, he is laying a trap for his vanity. And those concerns about his character are going to eventually get him to quickly become the run-of-the-mill politician that Lucas needs him to be. Trading in those great ideals for a standard non-answer in order to not look foolish and to not be completely laughed off that stage. Every step of the way, Lucas is shaping the way that McKay feels about things, and he does it not by scolding or yelling or threatening, but instead by offering to help and steering him towards that typical route, in air quotes, that successful politicians take. Boyle is fantastic here, his eyes glittering madly behind those glasses, thoughtfully stroking his beard while we get to hear McKay speaking, parroting back words that Lucas has given him. The puppeteer deftly maneuvering the invisible strings that only he can see. Something I must add, if authentic McKay doesn't sell and doesn't play to larger audiences, if he has to change himself, water down his positions until he is the perfect embodiment of being this bland, non-threatening, and unoriginal candidate, and he is based on John Tunney, what does this say about us as a voting population then? What does it say about us as a people now? All that being said, this film holds up quite well today, in my opinion. It's a take on how a person can slowly make a series of what they feel are only small compromises, and in the process, they get further and further away from where they wanted to be. And if I can be so preachy for a moment to say, perhaps more people who wish to get into a life of public office should maybe watch this film first. You know, just a thought. That being said, I'm not the only person that has opinions about this film, and that's all right. It's a good thing, because that's exactly why we have The Sidecar. Okay, so I know it's been a minute, but joining us again today in the sidecar is the one, the only Dan Felton, the ever so genial and knowledgeable host of one of my personal favorite shows to listen to, the Assorted Goods Podcast. That's a bi-weekly news podcast that covers stories and topics that you may have missed. Dan has some opinions about the candidate, and I am looking forward to hearing them. So without further ado, please, take it away, Dan.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me swing back around to the show, this time to dive into the candidate. And hey, what a coincidence. You Americans are right in the height of an election season. There must be something to that whole coincidence. Now anyways, The Candidate was released in 1972, and yet the politics of the movie feel really familiar. It's a classic story of a long shot. Robert Redford plays Bill McKay, the son of a former reputable politician who gets handpicked to run as the potential Democratic nominee for a California Senate seat by a political strategist named Marvin Lucas, played by Peter Boyle, who, to me, will always be the monster in Young Frankenstein. But anyways, first things first. I have an appreciation for the consistency of the politics being kind of all in the family in the film for Robert Redford's character, as it often is in America and, well, elsewhere too. McKay is an ideological candidate, pushing policies that are mildly progressive by today's standards, but I guess in the early 70s must have been really something game-changing. McKay's an environmentalist who believes in giving more of a voice to the people. Such a naive idea that is in a democracy, right? His campaign, despite a quick start as he becomes the Democratic nominee, quickly turns against him as he struggles to reach any voters in the middle of the political spectrum, which is often the struggle for so many politicians, winning those undecided votes. Don Porter plays McKay's opponent, Senator Crocker Jarman, a name that oozes Republican in its own right. Now, he's a longtime incumbent who has the boring but reliable political persona to keep things as they are. Jarman is not shaken by the upstart candidate, who's also much younger than him. And the way Jarman runs his campaign is pretty typical, in the same manner that many incumbents do, by simply saying that things have been great, and with me, they'll still be just as good. Now, the candidate is definitely riddled with political cliches, but also, to me, has an authentic feel to the process of campaigning. I'm probably wrong, since my experience with political campaigns is, well, zero. But the scenes with the army of hovering political aides feel hectic, and they probably should feel that way. Politics is always filled with advisors running polls, analyzing the numbers, and what moves might bump things a couple of points in a favorable direction. And many of the scenes in between the more pivotal moments of the film show advisors trying to piece together a winning coalition of voters and giving advice on approaches. Now, I have to say, I was a little thrown off by the fact that McKay both seems to be struggling at the start, attempting, mostly without success, to meet union workers, for example, and trying to relate to demographics outside his own, such as a scene where McKay visits the community of Watts, a heavily impoverished African-American community, and he doesn't really seem to be able to relate to the people he meets there. And yet, he breezes through the nomination process to become the opponent in the Senate race. Well, I guess you gotta keep the film moving, right? But despite that, I again thought the scenes created a good atmosphere for what it was trying to do. The title of the movie is The Candidate, but the focus really is more on the campaign. Redford as Bill McKay, to me, feels more like a character cast for the look and the persona, since McKay doesn't really have much depth beyond his basic ideologies. To me, The Campaign might have been a better title for the film. At some points of the film, I felt like the story was more about Peter Boyle's character, the political strategist Marvin Lucas, and his attempts to create a winner, even if he goes into the race telling McKay he's guaranteed to lose. But anyways, back to the authenticity of the way the story is told. Scenes across the film are honest about how campaigns work. For instance, the scene where his advisors attempt to run a mock interview to test McKay's ability to answer tough questions, something that politicians often do. And it's an awkward scene. Advisors are tossing questions and ideas out until McKay just gets overwhelmed and storms out of the room. Also, all the scenes in the hotel rooms, ramshackle office setups, they're both common staging areas for candidates constantly on the move. And something subtle I noticed, whether it was intentional or not, which I believe it probably was, but McKay also appeared to be having an affair with a woman in glasses who appears multiple times. That may not have been a focal point of the plot at any given moment, but the fact that it blended so nicely into the background, I actually didn't mind. I kept kind of expecting it to come back, but it never really turns into anything more other than just being that, a subtle, behind-the-scenes, almost, and really easy-to-miss plot point of the film. Now, one of the most pivotal scenes of the movie is the debate, which is something we may all be a little too familiar with after the past couple of weeks. But what really, I guess you could say, depressed me about this scene was how many of the political points the two candidates debate that are so similar to the debates that get held today. This movie was almost 50 years old now. The cycle of politics really hasn't changed all that much. McKay and Jarman debate over abortion rights, environmental policy, public education, healthcare, the ideas of being tough on crime. In the closing arguments of the debate, Jarman accuses McKay of aiming to destroy the well-established American systems if he gets elected, and of himself maintaining the greatness of America. Yikes, sounds familiar. McKay takes a risk in his closing argument and tries to hammer home some larger points about systematic problems of race and poverty, two topics that also haven't changed very much in nearly 50 years since the release of this film. I also noticed that although McKay begins the film as an upstart, as the campaign goes on throughout the film, it molds him into being much closer to a really run-of-the-mill typical politician. He's spouting slogans and working lines to drive the polls in his favor and reel in a prospective voter or two. And at the end of the film, his father, the former politician himself, tells McKay, "You're a politician now." The premise of the movie is he's an outsider candidate who gets to say what he wants. But in a way, the politics monster eats him by the end of it, and McKay never really gets the deal he's given at the start of the movie by the strategist Lucas. McKay gets told at the start of the movie that he'll be able to speak his mind freely, and yet he doesn't really get to so much. Or more so, when he does speak his mind, it falls flat with the voters, and he ends up having to resort to typical political strategy and slogans in order to win over voters. And also, earlier on, he gets told that he's guaranteed to lose, something that doesn't end up happening either. Now, in terms of how the film was made, or I guess in more of a technical analysis of it, and trust me, I'm no expert in that area, but the pacing felt good to me, and I gotta tell you, I'm a bit of a stickler for pacing. As for how the scenes unfold, again, I like how hectic so many of the scenes feel. Sometimes it's almost overwhelming, and it's also that way for the characters too, but that provides a good sense for the very setting of the film. It's a campaign, it's a dead sprint to a win or a loss, so of course it's crazy and crowded and noisy and overwhelming. The crowded rooms, the characters shouting over each other, the almost anxiety-inducing sense of everyone always being on the clock. Now take the scene where Lucas and McKay have a quick conference at a small, dirty bathroom. People are banging on the door, trying to get in and keep things moving, while the characters are just trying to get a quick word in. Or even at the end of the film, McKay, after being announced as the winner, has to run to a different part of the hotel he's in with Lucas, just so they can get 2 seconds to talk. And even then, it doesn't last that long. The sense I got watching the film was that the campaign was like this tornado that just kept sweeping everyone up in every moment all the time, and I imagine that must be what it's like to actually be in a political campaign. But the way the scenes were laid out, to me, got that point across. So I guess I could say that I see what the filmmakers were trying to do, and I think that they did a pretty good job of going for it. There's also a little clever dialogue, some jokes that feel honest about politics, a couple of predictable movie-appropriate speeches, and the film is well shot too. A lot of the big scenes and big areas really do a good job of making it feel like an impactful speech where people are engaged in what they're hearing. I also have no complaints from a technical or structural standpoint. But I will also point out, I did like the cyclical nature of the way the story was told. It starts on an election night, ends with an election night. Which is one of the reasons that I again say that the film feels sometimes a little more like it's about Marvin Lucas, the political strategist, moving from one race to the next, trying to pick a winner, more than it is about Redford's central character Bill McKay and his handsome politician sort of persona. At the end of the film, McKay wins his unlikely election, and yet seems displeased with winning. The reality of being a politician settles in. The last scene of the movie is McKay and Lucas hiding away in a hotel room for a brief moment as his victory is unfolding, and McKay says to Lucas, "What do we do now?" He then repeats the line as he gets drowned out as a crowd of people move in and sweep him up to celebrate. And to me, it begs the question, was it really only about finding a way to win? Was the campaign all that mattered? And it got me thinking, in the real world here, are there candidates, politicians, strategists, advisors, and the such who really are just about the thrill of the win and not about the job of governance, you know, the thing you're actually trying to do in the end? Really? Probably. probably more about the thrill of the chase than there is of the actual mundane day-to-day of doing the job and serving the people. McKay's befuddlement at the idea of now actually having the job, to me, is the lasting image of the candidate, and is another reason that I feel like Marvin Lucas may be the more important character in the end. At the beginning of the movie, he starts at a rally for a candidate of his who just lost and is conceding, and he runs off to find his next candidate and sees if he can make a winner. You'd have to assume, as the door closes in the final seconds of the film, Lucas would be off to his next thrilling campaign trail to do it all over again. To me, and maybe it's just the moment we're all in right now, but the candidate still holds up well. It's an authentic portrayal of the backroom strategy and the piecing together of a political campaign. The themes are still relevant, the atmosphere comes across as believable, and the characters all play a clear role in the film, from the sleazy political advertising guy, to Lucas, the campaign manager, to McKay's Republican opponent. They all feel like familiar characters to watch. I enjoyed The Candidate. Is it the greatest political film I've ever seen? No. Far from it, I guess, but it sets out to tell a specific story, and I think it does that well. My only knock? Really might be the name of the film, which seems to focus on Redford's character. Even the cover art for the film is always a picture of him, when I really felt like the story was more about the campaign itself than the candidate. But anyways, I give this movie a thumbs up on my arbitrary rating system of either thumbs up or thumbs down, which I just made up right now. Real original, isn't it? Anyways, Chris, thanks for having me back on the show. This was awesome. I enjoyed watching the film. And to you folks, thanks for listening to me ramble. My name is Dan. I host the Assorted Goods podcast, where every episode I make the attempt to dive deeper into topics, big and small, all in the effort to help me, and hopefully you, get a little smarter. Maybe. And one of my recent episodes, number 38, is about democracy. Jeez, another good coincidence. And you can find Assorted Goods anywhere you get your podcasts. I hope you'll stop by for a listen soon. Thanks again, stay safe, and take care of yourselves out there.
Shoot. Well, okay, so Dan has clearly shown that I am no longer needed to do this gig, because he's perfectly capable of sliding in and providing breakdowns on films and giving much-needed analysis. I had mentioned documentary style, but Dan really hits the nail on the head when he mentions how this film conveys the great hustle and bustle that goes on behind the scenes. You know, the manic action before the debates, the answering of phones, the frantic passing out of sandwiches on the bus, because nobody involved, from the candidate on down to the volunteers, has actual time to stop and eat. And not that we are dissimilar, although I would say, as being one of our Canadian neighbors to the north, Dan really gets to lord what seems to be the very enviable level of stability right now over us. And it's always appreciated and, you know, nice to have someone who's on the outside, looking in on the American political process and sharing what it looks like to them. A perspective that in turn shows us, as Dan here notes, how the more things change, the more they stay the same over a 50-odd year period that have passed between when this film was shot and our present-day circumstances. So I'll say this as a shameless plug for him. If you like that level of thoughtful commentary and reflection on this and a host of other topics, please go check out the Assorted Goods podcast, support our friends, and learn a thing or two along the way. Man, as always, Dan, thank you so much. That was excellent. So I can hear you out there. You're all asking, hey Chris, how was this film received? Well, when it was released on June 29th, 1972, The Candidate was met with some interesting mixed criticism. The people who loved it, loved it. It was lauded by the New York Times, Variety, the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the LA Times, with commentators noting its sharp comedy, its topical nature, and its general compelling appeal. Redford was praised for his performance, and in the case of director Ritchie, it was Roger Ebert who would laud him for his documentary realism. Now, there were also detractors, shockingly, I know, from more conservative outlets. Gary Arnold of the Washington Post called it a remarkably shallow film, with many other outlets also commenting on the dramatic payoff that was missing. They complained that Redford didn't deliver on the appropriate level of pathos to show a man so desperate to win that he sells out his morals. Some, like Penelope Gillett of The New Yorker, took a stand on being offended by Redford's McKay seeming to be molded on one of the late Kennedy brothers, but that seems to be sort of an intellectual stretch for me. You have a young, hopeful politician that could fit the bill of any young, hopeful politician in the era. Indeed, it's interesting to me, these negative reviews seem to be unable to really grasp the fact that this whole movie is about the banality of evil, and how it's the series of small, seemingly at the time inconsequential compromises one makes, just because they want something far more dramatic and cinematic. Therefore, they miss the point of the film itself. It's less real than what Ritchie, Larner, and Redford were going for if they play up high drama. So in short, they completely miss the point. In a certain sense, though, it didn't matter. This film did well at the box office. You know, it broke even, it made a small profit, it ended up making $2.5 million. It would go on to win the Oscar for Best Screenplay, and the following year, it would basically be consistently sought, and it's now hailed as a modern classic to be viewed by anyone who's interested in politics or is studying politics. As of this recording, The Candidate holds an 87% with critics and a 74% with the audience on Rotten Tomatoes, which is a testament to its staying power. Although, as we all know, anything that can be misunderstood will be misunderstood. My evidence of that is this. Dan Quayle, former vice president and department store mannequin brought to life, gave interviews back on the campaign trail in 1988, speaking about how great this movie was and how it inspired him. That's the scary part. That caused such anger in screenwriter Larner that he ended up penning an op-ed in the New York Times explaining to George Herbert Walker Bush's running mate that he was completely missing the point and the irony of the film, chiding the walking turnip, stating, "Mr. Quayle, this is not a how-to movie. This is a watch-out movie. And you are what we should be watching out for." And to think, that man was just a heartbeat away from the Oval Office. The version of The Candidate screened here at the LSCE was the Warner Brothers 1997 DVD release that came pretty bare bones. Just a couple of production notes and a theatrical trailer and not much else. Back in the day, this was actually rather typical for a lot of Warner Brothers release films. They would often use those cardboard slip sleeves that were not exactly the sturdiest. It would later be re-released in a snap case in 2005, still with no new features, but you had a better box to protect your DVD. And both of those, I'm sorry to say, have now basically gone out of print. You can find, quote, new copies of those versions circulating online, but due to scarcity, they've been bumped up to being exorbitant in price. You can find it on Amazon for $48.99, and I would not recommend shelling out for that. So, if you can find yourself a cheaper edition on eBay or, you know, go on a different vendor or alt site, I would highly recommend it. Now, there are cheaper versions that you can find online, even on Amazon, but you need to take this into account. They are alternate DVD regions, so it'll be The Candidate for Region 2 for $8.99, but unless you have a region-free DVD player, and hey, you should, you will not be able to play this DVD. I find this all to be highly disappointing. This film is marvelous, and it is a perfect, excuse the pun, candidate for a film to be polished up and given a really nice update for a Blu-ray release. Still, For those of you wishing to see the film, it is available for digital download or rental through Amazon Prime, and I would tell you it is more than worth the $5.99 it would cost you to own digitally. Now, remember folks, we don't get anything here from telling you where to buy items from. We just feel it's important in this day and age to continue to support physical media, so that the companies that own the rights to these fine films that we so enjoy to consume will continue to release them to us, the viewing public. And at the end of the day, isn't that what you want? You want to get more of those films that you love to see? Besides, The Candidate is interesting, culturally important, and it's still a very relevant film to our world today, and it needs to be seen. So what are you waiting for? Go ahead, get yourself a copy today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. We really hope to have you back soon. I'd like to again extend a special thank you to Dan Felton for his participation in the sidecar this week. Please do yourself the favor. Go listen, like, and subscribe to his estimable Assorted Goods podcast today. For my money, his recent episode on democracy is indeed great, but his interview with author Matt Hongoltz-Hetling on A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear, that should be required listening for people. It's funny and informative. Please support our friends. Check it out today. If you like us, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button, or hey, just do that wherever you're listening to us. Swing by and check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. I'm happy to announce we are recently added to Amazon Music, so if you have an account, you can simply say, "Hey, Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured, of course, on Podchaser. That's a podcast database for listeners and creators alike. Please find us there, give us a follow and a review if you could, please. And hey, feel free to like any of those lists we're a part of. That gives us a boost in the old rankings. More reviews and increased likes, that affects those marvelous algorithms, and thus it makes us more searchable, and then we can share more films with people. And that's what you want to do, right? You want to share films, don't you? Of course you do! And as always, if you'd like to get in touch with us, make a comment, ask a question, send us wonderful things, please email us at lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. If you'd like to even be more personal and wish to contribute a segment to the sidecar, hey, great! Send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app to use. So, until next time, please take care out there, wash your hands, maintain social distancing, wear a mask, and please, please stay healthy. And remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.